Attorney Michael Lukey, representing Mr. Danba.
My name is Michael Lukey, and I appear on behalf of the plaintiff respondent petitioner, Dan Danbeck. This is a case which arises out of an auto accident from September of 1995. It was a basic intersection accident. My client was on a bicycle. He was hit by a vehicle that turned left in front of him, and he sustained a serious leg injury. The vehicle that struck him had insurance limits of $50,000, and Mr. Danbeck had underinsured motorist coverage with American Family. Mr. Danbeck pursued a claim against the limits of the person who struck him as Country Home Mutual Insurance. For economic reasons, he settled that case for $48,000 out of a potential $50,000 in coverage with Country Home Mutual, and told his UIM carrier that he was going to pursue an underinsured motorist case and that he was going to settle for $48,000, gave them the right to exercise their Volk rights under the Volk case, and indicated that he would give them full credit on the underinsured motorist claim up to those $50,000 limits. American Family has denied his claim based on a one sentence contained in the endorsement for underinsured motorist on page 9 of his policy, which simply says that he did not exhaust by payment of judgment or settlements the underlying coverage, and for that reason we are here. In my petition for review to this court, I indicated that this decision would affect every case, every underinsured motorist claim that would ever occur in this state. There's always at least three parties to an underinsured motorist claim. We have the injured person, we have the underinsured motorist carrier, and then we have the UIM carrier. As stated in the Rucker case, the Iowa case, there's a minimum of three parties, and therefore settlement gets complicated.
Sir, let me ask you a question. Perhaps it's too early, but this case was $48,000 out of a total of $50,000 that was available.
That's correct.
The question would be basically, how could this court determine whether you as plaintiff or any plaintiff would be entitled to the uninsured motorist benefits if you don't maximize that? Is there some cutoff? Would you feel differently if this was $50,000 and you got $8,000, and then you would and then there's a $200,000 UIM pot? Is there any line drawing to be here, and if so, is that a policy?
There can be line drawing, and that was addressed in the trial court opinion, and the trial court refused to draw that line, but there are cases, and I believe it was the case subsequent to the Bogan case in Ohio, which did raise a line as far as a determination whether the discount would reflect a reasonable discount for the cost to pursue that extra money. And in the court's example, yes, 8 out of 50, that would seem to be unreasonable. And I would not have a problem, frankly, with a test of that sort, although it does raise another level of factual inquiry, and the trial court simply went along with Bogan and the other cases that I've cited and said that no matter what the discount, as long as there's a credit given, that should be sufficient. One of the cases cited by the defense is the Watnick case, and I think that's a good example of a case that bad facts made bad law. In that case, there was an underlying court, it was a Canadian court, that had actually awarded $82.12 to the injured party, and his wife was 100% at fault. And then they pursued a UIM claim. And I think the court was taken by those facts and just simply said, you're not going to allow this in this context. I think it was along those lines.
Let me just ask you this question. You have a settlement between the injured party and the tortfeasor.
Yes.
Let's just say, out of court settlement.
Yes.
And it's for $48,000, or it could be for $2,000. I don't care. Now, the injured party goes after the insurance company, the other insurance company. The other insurance company says, I don't think that this was negligent, and I don't think it was causal. And I really doubt your injuries, too. Can you get a trial on those facts?
Sure.
So the uninsured or underinsured motorist carrier can litigate that, not barred by the settlement.
Definitely.
Okay. So it shouldn't matter whether it was $2 or $48,000. I suppose even if there was a settlement for $50,000, the underinsured motorist carrier could say that's all your damages were worth, $50,000 or $52,000.
No question about it. Or they could say, we don't believe that the underinsured carrier, we think they paid too much. We think your claim was only worth $30,000, and we're entitled to defend it, and we will.
All right, so that's at the settlement stage. What about, I don't remember peer injury leases and all that stuff. It doesn't come into play?
Well, a peer injury release would come into play if there were multiple defendants. In our case, there's only one defendant, and theoretically, and there are some cases cited where there are multiple defendants, and it does get a little more complicated in that context.
But on a single defendant issue with the underinsured motorist carrier, that doesn't come into play. Okay, now I'm going to move away from the settlement into, and this is a settlement case, right?
Yes.
I'm going to move into a trial. So there's a trial relating to negligence, causation, and damages between Dan Beck and the tortfeasor. American Family would become a party, wouldn't it?
I think they would be offered the chance to participate. I don't know that they would have to participate.
Okay, well, let's not make them a party. And let's say that they don't get the offer, or they decline the offer to participate, and then you get a jury verdict that says no negligence, no liability, no damages. Now Dan Beck goes after American Family, or maybe they get $1,000 damages. I'll change my. So does American Family get the benefit of that jury verdict?
I think they should.
Pardon me?
I think they should.
They should. They're not parties, so you guess it's issue preclusion, maybe?
I would think so. I have not looked at that issue, but certainly they at the very least, they would be entitled to a defense.
What I'm driving at here, and I'll ask the same thing of opposing counsel, is what are the risks or the disadvantages to American Family if we say that if you pay the extra $2,000, they are liable to you. What's the downside?
You mean in this case,
yeah,
asking them to pay the additional $2,000?
Right. No. The downside of asking them to pay the extra $50,000, or whatever the amount was. It was more than that. I want to know, what's the downside, the legal argument against doing what you want?
I'm sorry, I misunderstand. Is the court focusing in on the discount?
No, I'm assuming you're paying the $2,000, right?
Who's paying it? In the credit?
In the credit, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So what is the argument, the best argument against your interest here that you can make to hold the way American Family wants you to hold?
Well, I think they've made it in their briefs, trying to simply stick to the strict construction language for policy reasons and ambiguity reasons and interpretation of the policy. I don't think they can make any better argument than the clear language.
Clear language of the policy is the best argument. Otherwise, they're not necessarily hurt.
I would agree with that. They have raised a couple other issues. They make a statement that they haven't factored in defense costs in their brief, and they make an argument that it's definitional, that somehow if they don't exhaust this, it fails the definition of an underinsured motorist, both of which there's absolutely no evidence in the record as to defense costs. There's no evidence in the trial record whatsoever that it affects that, and there's no mention in the definition of underinsured motorist of what they talk. But getting back to what started me down this road, the example, yeah, there may be some weird examples where somebody who only gets $1,000 might attempt to pursue what, in essence, I would consider a frivolous claim against a UIM carrier. But the concerns I'm more concerned with are cases, you know, not everybody retains a lawyer in a severe personal injury case. And almost by definition, an underinsured motorist claim is going to be somebody who's significantly injured because we're usurping the underlying limit. So it's somebody with a significant injury, a death case, a serious injury that impairs work impairment. And there are people out there who, for whatever reason, will not retain a lawyer. And somebody could have a policy that they paid premiums on, include uninsured motorists for years, and their loved one or themselves get seriously injured and they can't put food on the table, or they don't have wages coming in. And they have to settle. They make a claim against the tortfeasor's carrier, and that carrier owes them no duty to inform them what might happen with the UIM aspect of things. That carrier has stated in Rucker that even under clear facts, liability and damages, oftentimes those carriers are still trying to save a little bit off the limits because they know they can save a little bit off the limits because you have to pursue it.
Mr. Lipke, could I ask
yes.
a question? I used to serve in the legislature, and in the legislature we debated policy. And I'll tip my hand here and I say, I'm convinced the policy is on your side. But I'm looking at the text of this policy. And you've got to give me a persuasive reason why it is that the text of this policy can just be ignored. Because the text is, we will pay under this coverage only after the limits of liability under the bodily injury liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by payment of the judgments or settlements. How is it that we can just sort of look away from this language and debate policy?
Well, I'll give you a couple of reasons, Your Honor. If a policy clause is subject to more than one construction, this court has said it's ambiguous. This court in Teagan took the exact same clause in a slightly different motorist context, insurance context, and it interpreted differently than the exact language. The other reason is contained in this court's most recent decision on underinsured motorist in Dauhauer, that it's not only the language itself that you look at, but it's the language within the context of the whole insurance contract. If you look at the contract and issue here, it's just as bad in the sense of ambiguity, at least, as the Dauhauer case. This contract, which is contained at page 121 of my appendix, simply lists on the face sheet that underinsured motorist coverage of $100,000 each person will be provided. And it says endorsement-C below. So if a policyholder sees this deck sheet, which that's the only thing most people look at, he sees he's got the coverage and he sees endorsement-C below. And if you read below, there's a nice little paragraph from the president of American Family that really has nothing to do with underinsured motorists. If you turn to the table of contents, the quick reference for coverages simply says see declarations. And then below is the table of contents, which has six different sections, uninsured motorists and other coverages. It has nothing about underinsured motorist coverage. Nothing. Back to the example of the seriously injured family member. If he gets an offer from the tortfeasor's insurance carrier, $49,000, and he said, and the tortfeasor's insurance carrier says, we're not going to pay you anymore. If you want that last $1,000, sue us. He says, well, I could go retain a law firm and pay them a third, and then I'd be immediately down to 33, so I'm going to be smart. I'm going to take this $49,000, and I'm going to walk over to my agent and say, this UIM coverage I've been paying all these years for, now I'm going to use it to make a claim because my wife or loved one has been seriously injured or killed. And the adjuster for that company is going to say, sorry, sir, you don't have UIM coverage, even though you've paid the premium. And he's going to say, what are you talking about? It says right there on the deck sheet, $100,000 or $250,000 or whatever it is. And they're going to say, well, you didn't read page 9. It's not in your policy. It's not on the deck sheet. It's not in the table of contents. If you turn to the endorsement, Mr. Smith, you'll see not in the limit of liability section of that endorsement and not in the exclusion section, but simply one sentence on page 9. It says, unfortunately, you have to exhaust the underlying coverage by payment of judgment or settlements, so you get nothing. And that is the real concern of what this Court of Appeals ruling affects. Every person in that circumstance who chooses with good intentions to save money for their family on a UIM claim of that type, where they arguably don't need an attorney in a very serious injury case, if they take $1 less, the UIM carrier can simply turn to them and say, look at this sentence here in page 9. I'm sorry, we can't give you the $200,000 in coverage that you have been paying premiums for all these years.
Counsel, my colleague, Justice Prosser, talked about, he thought the legislative policy could possibly favor. I'm not going to ask him what policy he's referring to or what statute, but do you know, is there a statute or is there a legislative policy that you can cite to that this court could use to show that it would bolster your position as far as interpreting or accepting your interpretation of how this case should come out?
Well, I've cited the case law policies of encouraging settlement and favoring coverage.
Is there a statute or anything from
the legislature? Well, the obvious statute is 632.32 that relates to underinsured motorists, and in that statute, it doesn't mandate UIM as some states do. It encourages it, and there are permissible provisions and prohibited provisions, neither of which discuss this clause. But I guess the only thing I've thought of, and it's really sort of an inference by absence, the Teagan case was an automotive insurance case, and it did interpret a clause which is identical to this one. And the Teagan case, I believe, is 1985.
But it didn't discuss the exhaustion clause, did it?
It did discuss the exhaustion clause.
Why don't you give us the exact language of the policy? Where is it in your brief?
The exact language of the policy is contained at
page 7.
Okay.
It's page 129 of the appendix also, which is the policy itself.
Okay, well, I want to read that.
It says, and it's
Teagan. Just a minute, let me find that. Okay, go ahead.
It's the UIM coverage endorsement. We will pay, quoting, we will pay under this coverage only after the limits of liability under any bodily injury liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by payment of judgments or settlements.
Okay, now let me read you the language from Teagan, okay? And everybody can follow along. There, the policy provided that it shall not be obligated to defend any suit. And that's the difference. This is a defense, but here's the kicker language. After the applicable limit of the company's liability has been exhausted by payment of judgments or settlements. And you think that language is the same as in this case?
Well, from the has been exhausted by payment of judgments or settlements, from that point on, it's exactly identical.
And that's the language that had to be interpreted.
Right. And in Teagan, they focused in on the word exhaust and decided that the strict interpretation that was being asked for was not, they did not want to apply such a strict application. And they interpreted exhaust as satisfied by the type of settlement in Teagan. And all I'm saying in response to Justice Wilcox's question is that this case predated the change in the statute, which I believe was 1995, and it interpreted a clause very similar to the one at issue today.
Counsel, let's say I'm a private person. And I contract with Justice Prosser. We enter into a contract. And the language of our private contract says, I will pay under this contract only after the limits of liability under any bodily injury liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by payment of judgment or settlements. That's the language we're talking about here. What word or words in that sentence are ambiguous? When Justice Prosser asked you about that, you started talking about ambiguous in the context. Well, I, as you know, recently wrote a dissent on ambiguous in the context, so I know where you're coming from. But I want to know on these words of this sentence in a private contract, what words are ambiguous?
Well, the two words that the courts of this state have interpreted differently than the clear language that was asserted were exhausted in Teagan and payment in Kelly.
Okay, but let me just respond. Now, my recollection, there's been a lot of cases cited. One case I looked at was the Connecticut case that by statute had the same language as this private contract.
That's correct.
And said that language was not ambiguous.
That's correct.
I know Teagan, if I recall, is a different policy. The whole emphasis was duty to defend there. Okay, so let's maybe Teagan can be distinguished, maybe it can't. But I want to focus on this sentence. These words. Tell me what you think is ambiguous about these words in this sentence.
Could I just jump in? Please. Suppose we didn't have the Teagan case. How would you argue that this language is ambiguous?
Without going to the Dauhauer contextual aspects of it, I would argue the same way they did in Kelly, that payment... What does payment mean? Does it mean payment in cash? Does it mean payment in kind? Does it mean partial payment in cash and a partial credit? You can think of a number of different ways to theoretically exhaust something equivalent to $50,000. And then that dovetails with what does exhaust mean? Does that mean you have to exhaust it a certain way? I mean, really the focus is how you exhaust that $50,000, whether it's a combination of a credit, cash, or something else. In Kelly, it was a deductible. So,
what does pay, what does the third word in the clause mean?
The third word in we will pay?
We will pay. I mean, payment at the end mean something different than payment at the beginning, or pay in the beginning?
Well, the first pay, I assume, is paid by American Family. The payment referred to at the end of the sentence is the payment from the tortfeasor's liability carrier. So in that sense, yes, I believe they're referring to different things.
But I mean, the concept of pay, does it mean something different in different parts of the sentence?
Well, I can make an argument that it does. Oftentimes the cases are settled without payment in cash. They're settled payment of structures or forgiveness of debt. You can pay other ways than simply a cash payment.
I don't know why this. You think this is ambiguous. It seems to me that it says that American Family is going to pay when the other party is finished paying. As soon as they're done, there's still liability out there for the amount of money. It's ours. Because you can, it depends on what you mean by limits of liability. It can mean that if the policy says 50 grand, they got to pay 50. Or it can mean as soon as they're done with their liability, regardless whether they pay 50 grand or $55,000. Suppose, out of the goodness of the heart, this insurance company, because it has a whole, it's got issues about the policy and whether it was done by fraud, etc., pays $55,000. It's only liable for 50, but it wants to get rid of the whole thing. What are you going to say, that you're not, that the other company isn't liable over the 55? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I guess under that example, I would say that the UIN carrier should be credited with the full 55. I can't fathom that happening, but...
Well, but you don't know what else is involved.
There may be something else involved
in here. Maybe some kind of fraud after the fact of getting coverage, and they want to get rid of all these claims. So they pay more than their share. Maybe it's a bad faith claim. So if you read limits of liability, that would mean the $50,000 in their policy. Then if they pay more than that, you'd lose this case. And if they pay less, you'd lose. But if you mean limits of liability, meaning after their liability is settled and finished, then you should win. I don't know why you find this ambiguous.
Well,
you'd like to agree with me if that's okay too, right?
I'd like to agree with you. I can tell you the trial court found it ambiguous, but the cases I have cited have not used that term, that it's ambiguous, but they have used terms such as they disagree with so strict an application, they interpret the statute as not requiring full payment. It is best construed as a threshold requirement, not a barrier to coverage. They use words where they could say it's ambiguous, but they choose to use words of construction, the way they interpret it or construe it. I see my time is up, though. Unless there's any other questions, I'll defer to counsel with the understanding that I have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Right. Thank you, Mr. LaPierre.
You have
5 minutes in rebuttal. And E. Curtis, representing American Family. Ms. Curtis.
May it please the court, counsel. The exhaustion clause provides a bright line, and it is a bright line that is in conformance with the type of insurance coverage that underinsured motorist coverage is, and that is, it is a backup. By definition, it has a relationship to the tortfeasor's liability limits. And when those limits are inadequate, when those limits are exhausted, it is at that point that underinsured motorist coverage comes into play. The clear language of the contract here is that the sums of the liability limit must be exhausted. And as this court has already noted, the language is clear. It does provide a bright line. Counsel brought up an instance where a plaintiff would, I think his fact pattern, consider that he or she would be completely oblivious to the contractual provisions in the insurance contract. Well, certainly there's going to be a detriment had if they're oblivious to all of the contract provisions. But what this court has noted is if there is clear language and they read the clear language, and they interpret it, they would know that they cannot accept $1 less, that they must accept all of the liability limits.
So your position is that if the other company can settle out this suit for less than their maximum liability, that can destroy underinsured motorist coverage?
Yes.
And is it your position if the company settles for more than the limits of liability because of extraneous matters like bad faith, fraud, or that would also take it out of underinsured motorist?
No, because they would have exhausted the limits. They've exceeded it, but they've certainly exhausted.
Suppose it was $30,000 for personal injury and $25,000 for bad faith.
That would not be exhausted. And that's an interesting factual point that's brought up here. We've been talking about $48,000. Well, it's $47,500. There was $500 for the bicycle. And what the clear language talks about is the bodily injury. So in the instance that you just said, no, they would not have exhausted the policy because of the $30,000 only being for the bodily injury.
What harm is there to you, to your company, if they'd settle for $48,000? You think there's a fraud on you? Especially if you get the credit. What harm is there?
Well, the harm is twofold. The first has to do with setting a precedent for the allowance or even the encouragement of ignoring plain and clear contractual language. That would set a precedent that we write these policies, Okay. The second would be a systemic harm. And that is what I think one of the first questions gotten to by this court is, if settle and credit were allowed, the plaintiff could only receive $1 of that tort fees or the wrongdoer's liability limits. That opens the floodgates. Rather than having a policy or a coverage when it was bargained for.
What floodgates are? You still get credit for $50,000 or whatever the limits of that liability. So what are the floodgates? You're liable for over $50,000 one way, you're liable for over $50,000 the other way.
But you're forced to get involved in lawsuits that have issues as to liability, that have issues as to damages. Those issues should be hashed out between the plaintiff and the wrongdoer and the tortfeasor.
But if there's a settlement, you may not agree with that settlement. They might figure, well, they better get out of here with $50,000 rather than risk a lawsuit and be caught for bad faith or defense damages. They just take that chance, and it's worth $50,000 as a nuisance. And if it's $25,000, so much the better. So you'd be stuck anyway. That's why I raised all these questions about does the fact that there's a settlement hurt you in any fashion if you're going to litigate it?
Well, it does hurt us because it opens the floodgates, and the underinsured motorist carrier now has to respond to claims like was in Watnick, where you have a claim that the plaintiff only was due $82.12 of a $20,000 policy. Now the underinsured motorist carrier, they have to try that case. That skews the difference between third-party and first-party liability insurance.
What about issue preclusion? There was a jury trial and it came back $82 and your American Family wasn't involved. Could you use that?
I think that what the policy says is that the underinsured, let's get to the language, it has to be legally liable, the liability insurer. So in that instance, where there had been a factual determination, I think that there is issue preclusion, and the plaintiff could not then go against their underinsured motorist carrier.
So you're not hurt?
No, I think that the American Family is hurt because now it must respond to all sorts of cases, not ones where there's liability outside of the damages or, pardon me, outside of the limit of the tortfeasor's liability insurance. That's where they normally come into play. They come in on indemnity. Now they have to come in right at the beginning. They are now charged with the duty of hashing out these issues of liability and or damages. Those sorts of issues should be hashed out between the plaintiff and the wrongdoer. But by allowing settle and credit, the plaintiff can take any sum, quite frankly, from the tortfeasor. Take that money, and then they have a situation where they're going against their natural adversary has become sort of their friend, and then their own insurer becomes their adversary.
So this is an actuarial consideration I'm talking about?
Yes.
So you want the battle, so to speak, to occur in the front?
Exactly.
And come in at a later...
The battle should be had between the plaintiff and the wrongdoer, the plaintiff and the tortfeasor's liability insurer.
Many states have, if I understand it, have this settle and credit approach, other jurisdictions. And it seems to work there, and I don't know what I'm driving at is that other than your expenses, you're talking about the expense of litigation. Talking about how your actuarial considerations for charging for your policy, that's what you're concerned about.
That's one of the concerns. However, an uninsured motorist carrier could also end up making the same determinations that a tortfeasor's liability insurer would make, looking at the risk, looking at what money's on the line, decide, hey, we'll pay out $25,000, we'll pay out $30,000 just to get rid of the case. They should not be paying out that money. The money should be paid by the wrongdoer, by the tortfeasor's liability insurer. And this skews that. It allows a second kick at the cat. It allows the plaintiff to take whatever they can get from the tortfeasor, take it, and go against their own carrier. And that necessarily gives them a tactical advantage at trial. Because at the lower level, when you have the plaintiff he's made a contentious opponent by suing someone, it's contentious. If you eliminate that, you have bad faith, good faith against your own carrier. Conceitedly, UIM will, that type of situation, that carrier is always going to have to work with the tortfeasor, but it provides a tactical advantage. And if you're going to be trying your case, it would seem that it would be a benefit to the plaintiff, again, to take whatever they want from the tortfeasor and then go after their own carrier.
Counsel, I want to look at the language again.
Sure.
And I'm going to cut out a few words that are superfluous. And it says, we will pay under this coverage only after the limits of liability have been exhausted by settlement. Okay? Here, the limits of liability have been exhausted by settlement. The settlement is, let me say, $48,000 cash and $2,000 credit. That's what the settlement. Now, unlike the word before it, have been exhausted by payment of judgment. Judgment's a different thing. Judgment is, I can tell you the dollar and the cent, what the judgment is, and then you tax the cost, and you know that. But this is by settlement. Isn't there some ambiguity here? We will pay only after the limits of liability have been exhausted by settlement. This settlement provides for a $2,000 credit and a $48,000 payment of cash. $2,000 credit on the limits of liability. What's wrong with interpreting that sentence in that fashion?
Well, I think the first difficulty, and I know that you've put forth a hypothetical, but you are taking out significant language, and language that was put in for a purpose.
What's the significant language?
The payment.
I meant to just get to the focus. I didn't mean to take out any significant language. So tell me what significant
language
I took out.
Well, payment of settlement. Payment indicates that something is changing hands. Payment was also construed by both the appellate court and in our brief. It too is a word that's important to understand and to translate.
Payment of judgments or settlements. Okay. I kept that payment word in.
Credit is not a payment.
Pardon?
Credit is in no way a payment. And it certainly hasn't exhausted the limits. The limits of $48,000 are still gone. Now whether you say there's a credit.
Are they liable?
Is who liable?
The tortfeasor's insurance companies after a settlement. They're no longer liable, are they?
No.
Yeah. If I may, we've got the word here, or.
Okay.
So, payment of judgments. Okay. I'm not sure. Tell me. Payment of judgments is one thing, or settlements. It doesn't say payment of settlements.
Okay.
It doesn't say payment of judgments and settlements. It says payment of judgments or settlements. Tell me if this is a, why this interpretation is erroneous. We will pay. Under this coverage, only after the limits of liability have been exhausted by settlement. I mean, you've got payment of judgment or. Okay, so I've got an option. I'm talking about payment of judgment. It's been exhausted, limits of liability have been exhausted by that. Or it has been exhausted by settlement. In this case, settlement is 48 plus 48 cash to credit. What's wrong with that interpretation?
Because it doesn't satisfy what exhaust means. Exhaust means to use up whole supply. It means to expend, to consume entirely.
Well, let me, you know, I'm not sure about this, but that's what I'm asking you.
Sure.
I mean, it seems to me if the limit is 50,000 and we want to exhaust the 50,000 or get to the 50,000, we do that in settlement by combining credit and cash. Therefore, we get to the 50,000. Now, I know I'm saying get to by using that interchangeably with exhaust, but I think that's fair. I don't think that's a sleight of the hand. I mean, I think exhaust means get to the limit, get to the top. And we did this not by payment of judgment. We did this, in this case, by settlement. Settlement of 48 plus 2. What's wrong with that interpretation?
I disagree with your definition of exhaust, and I'm only citing the dictionary. Expend or consume entirely. And by taking $48,000 of $50,000, you are not consuming entirely. You are not exhausting the policy.
That seems to me that you're focusing on the word payment of judgments. And I'm not, I think a settlement, I'm just arguing, I think when you put a settlement together of cash and credit, that can consume the total amount of $50,000. It doesn't have to be payment of total of $50,000 under the words I'm arguing. You know, I mean, I'm not sure. I'm exploring. But it says, with that, it says payment of judgments or settlements. So here we, it's been exhausted because it's up to $50,000 by settlement, structured settlement.
My counter is you're asking me to assume that $48,000 consumes, uses up $50,000 because of some sort of agreement. I disagree. I think that the clear language says exhaust, to consume, to use up wholly.
One final question. What if the settlement is, I'll pay you $25,000, the insurance company says, and then I'll give you credit for something else. Let me see. I can't come up with a hypothetical. Maybe I'll give you extra credit on some property damage or something like that. In other words, I'm trying to come up with a hypothetical where they pay $25,000, but they won't ask for reimbursement of medicals. That's it. They won't ask for reimbursement of your medicals under their MedPay or, you know, some. So I'll give you $25,000, and although I should be able to ask for you for reimbursement of medicals of $60,000, I'll give you credit. And so we come to $50,000 limit. Do you understand my hypothetical? What I'm trying to do is get payment of cash
right.
by the insurance company, and the insurance company is also extending credit because the insurance company isn't asking for reimbursement of their $60,000 that they paid under the MedPay policy. But instead, they'll say, you know, make an incentive, we'll give you credits and call it a day, get to the $50,000 and go home. Can they do that?
No. They can do it, but it won't exhaust the policy.
It won't. Well, won't it be a settlement that they've exhausted the $50,000 limits on?
No.
Where the issue comes up, as I see it, and I'll go back to Justice Babbage. The insurer of the tortfeasor is no longer liable, whether it pays $1 or $49,000 once that settlement is reached, right?
Correct.
And it depends then on what this means. If it means they've got to pay the flat face value of the policy, then American Family is right and wins. If it means that the liability of the insurer has been exhausted, which is why I raised the issue of what limits of liability means. If it means that the liability of the insurer is exhausted, finished, complete, you can't get it anymore, then American Family loses, as I see it. And your position is the words limits of liability, and you should have objected to leaving out the words under any bodily injury liability bond or policy, means the face value of that policy, the other guy's policy, the insurer's policy, in that you got to pay the $50,000. So to use Justice Bradley's example, the other insurer owes $50,000. Put under the subrogation, the med pay, the insured, that is now your insured, the victim, might owe medical coverage payments. So insurer owes $50,000. The meds were $40,000, so the insurance company pays $10,000. Your answer to Justice Bradley was that that was not sufficient.
That would not exhaust the policy. That's correct.
Well, I guess my answer is that that policy was exhausted. I think that was your example, wasn't it, Justice Bradley? I think that, I changed the numbers to make them clearer. I think the liability is exhausted. You think that the insurance company had to pay $50,000 in one hand and then hanging on to that check, or had to give two checks, one for $40,000 and one for $10,000, and then take back the $40,000 check for the meds?
Well, your hypothetical gets into the issues that I was arguing earlier are best to be hashed out between plaintiff and tortfeasor. How much is owed? For what reason?
I'm hashing it out with American Family. I got two checks totaling $50,000. One was representing the $40,000 I owe back to the company for the meds. And the other is the $10,000, which makes up $50,000. So I wind up with $10,000 cash from that insurance company. So I want to hash it out with you now. I've gotten $50,000. One is a credit and one is cash. And you're saying that's not good enough.
Why are you underinsured? Are you owed more money?
It's $1,000,000.
Then you should get those from the tortfeasor. You should go back and get, you've taken $10,000 of the bodily injury, go back and get that $40,000. Because we're here at the end. We're here when they have inadequate funds. That's why we're here.
Can I ask a question? Does American Family ever find itself in a position where it is has a policy on both the tortfeasor and the victim?
Sure.
It's a big company.
Yes.
What happens when you go after the policy for the tortfeasor, an American Family sits on its hands and won't settle for unless it's for something less than $50,000? And when that happens, the other side, American Family, is going to have to pay anymore.
So we're creating bad faith. I mean, is the American Family that is the insurance for the liability, or for the tortfeasor? They're sitting on their hands so that they can save themselves money on the underinsured. Well, that would clearly be bad faith. I mean, that would be wrong. By having this exhaustion clause, I think actually it would be an impetus to the tortfeasor's liability insurer to max out, because they know, given the bright line of the language, that this plaintiff, if he or she feels that they have damages in excess of $50,000, has got to get that. They'll try the case to get that. So any credit given, any $2,000 given to the tortfeasor's liability limits isn't worth it. They would be more inclined to max out their policy, to give it all, rather than this $47,000 to save face, because they know the plaintiff will try the case in order to get that. And a great impetus for settling, and the amount of settlement, is to avoid that trial.
Could I ask one other question? If the court didn't agree with you on the policy considerations, is there any way to rule in favor of the plaintiff other than finding ambiguity in the text or inconsistency with the state statute? I mean, can we just say, we don't like the policy here?
Well, I would hope not, because that would be deriding contract law. The way that this court could rule in favor of the plaintiff would have to be what other courts have done, put forth by the petitioner. They have not ruled that the language is ambiguous. In fact, very few of them have gone through the necessary analysis to just look at the language. What they have done is cited policies that are prevalent in their state in order to interpret that language in a different manner. In the state of Wisconsin, we don't have that policy. We have a statute for underinsured motorist coverage that is a notice statute. It says you have to tell them one time that they can get this type of coverage, period, end of sentence. Far different than uninsured motorist. So in order for the plaintiff to prevail, there would have to be some policy that this court felt was being served by ignoring clear language. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay.
I was going to give you a policy.
Okay. Well, the policies that have been set forth are the ones favoring settlements, Loy versus Bunderson. And none of those objectives are met here, given the slippery slope that can happen. What I mean by that, Loy says it promotes efficient resolution of lawsuits. It's beneficial to the parties. It's beneficial to the court system. If you allow settle and credit, none of those objectives are met. Why? You're actually causing more lawsuits. Why? Because a plaintiff can look to their tortfeasor. You can give me whatever you want, $25,000 out of a $50,000, fine. I want to roll the dice, and I'm going to roll it against my carrier. I'll take that money. We have issues as to liability. We have issues as to damages. There's no impetus for the plaintiff to hash those issues out against the wrongdoer if they are allowed to settle in credit. They can take the money and run, file another suit against their carrier. And again, this is what I talked about earlier. Tactically, I think it's advantageous as a trial lawyer. If I'm in the shoes of the plaintiff, go against my carrier. The tortfeasor doesn't have to play with them. There's no cooperation clause. In addition, they have a duty of good faith and violations if they perform bad faith. So none of those objectives that are cited by counsel are met. There's a prejudice to the parties. There's a prejudice to the system, and it doesn't efficiently resolve lawsuits. It, in fact, creates lawsuits.
I was going to say there's a longstanding doctrine in this state that says you interpret insurance policies as the reasonable expectation of the insured who is buying the policy. And that's what our court did in Tekin. And it said that what the insurance company is being asked to do is no more than what it contracted for, to provide coverage to the insured in excess of that provided by the tortfeasor's insurance company. So why doesn't that follow? I mean, if I buy underinsured motorist coverage, I expect, if I'm not getting paid fully from the tortfeasor, and I get as much as I can from that tortfeasor, but it doesn't cover, that my policy comes into effect. And that's what I expect. And that's what our cases say the buyer expects.
Well, if you look at the language, that you have to put yourself in the place of a reasonable insured, what is that person going to think that the language that we've been arguing about all morning mean to them? Does it mean I can settle in credit? I don't think that's a reasonable interpretation as to what a reasonable insured would think. There's also, I think really, in your fact pattern, it doesn't, just because an insured thinks that, you know, I have this underinsured motorist coverage, it's going to come into play when? When the tortfeasors run out of money. It's, again, it's the backup position. It's the safety net. And the clear language belies any other expectation that that underinsured motorist carrier would come into play at any point earlier.
With great frequency, it seems to me there's an incentive for an attorney who's representing an insurance company. Let's say the limits are $50,000. If you can settle for $48,000, it looks good to the claims attorney. You know, if the claims attorney from the insurance company says, on any given case, I'm going to give you authority on this case for $70,000. If you can come in at $67,500, you're a hero, you know?
Sure.
So that happens with great frequency because that's part of the human dynamic. You want to look good, you get more employment. I mean, that's just the other side gets almost what they want, but not the total $50,000, for instance. It's good enough. You look good. They're happy. And that's the way it's done with great frequency. Doesn't that discourage, doesn't what you're arguing here discourage what are the realities, the nuts and bolts of settlement?
Sure. It discourages it, and it discourages it to the benefit of the plaintiff. Why are we throwing the tortfeasor's liability limits insurer a bone? Now, I know this is going to kill me tomorrow when I go to work, but why are we giving them the break? They're the ones that are responsible for this.
You get money in your hand right now.
Right. If we've got the plain language and we follow the plain language that here, if I, who represents the tortfeasor knows they've got to get every penny from me before they can go to their underinsured motorist carrier, and they feel very adamantly that they've sustained damages in excess of my policy, they're going to try the case against me. I don't want to try the case. I mean, when we're talking $47,000, $50,000, I'd be more inclined to give them the max so I don't have to try it over that small sum. So the policy, or by following the exhaustion clause, you do get away a little bit from that, but I think you do so to the benefit of the victim here.
Well, it seems to me that what you're saying is that the insurance company has legitimate reason for this. And that may be true. But what your argument creates, I'm pushing this as hypothesis for you to answer, it creates, I think, a very harsh burden on the plaintiff. Because if the plaintiff's insurance company, I mean the tortfeasor's insurance company, refuses to settle for the limits of their policy, even if it's a couple of $1,000s, as here, you're forcing the victim to incur costs to gain a little bit in order to come after you. Here, if he didn't accept $48,000, he was going to have to spend about one-third of $50,000 in order to exhaust the limits of liability, $16,000 or $17,000. So instead of $48,000, he's getting $33,000 because the attorney eats $17,000. Now, in weighing those two arguments, you know, the harshness against the insurance company, the harshness against who should prevail? Who's in a better position here? The insurance company to do this or the victim? Who should get the hit?
Your hypothetical assumes that,
it's not hypothetical, it's this case.
Well, that it's clear, that it's absolutely certain that the plaintiff is due monies in excess of that policy. There are lots of different reasons why a tortfeasor's liability insurer is going to say, no, you don't get the max. Maybe it's because it's not worth it. Maybe because there weren't damages that are provable. Maybe it's because liability is an issue. It's not clear cut. If those are the issues, those issues should be resolved at that level.
But here it's agreed that there's a total of $70,000 worth of injuries. And what you're saying is that the injured victim should have to pay an additional $17,000 in order to get the $20,000 from you. Doesn't seem like a real good deal to me.
What I'm saying is that the insured should follow the language of the policy. That's the first and necessary step. And if he or she chooses not to do so, then they bear the risk of losing what could be theirs if they had just followed what was there in clear in front of them.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Mr. Lupke, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel started her argument by saying the exhaustion clause is a bright line clause for whether coverage exists or not. I would assert it's one of the dumbest lines in this policy. Justice Prosser asked about another possible way to decide this case, and the one we haven't talked about is the Raines case. That involved also American Family. And that clause is on the same page we're looking at, and it's a one-line clause in the exclusion section that simply, and it was a Volt issue, it simply says this coverage does not apply for bodily injury to a
person. Sorry, we're not able to hear you. You know why your coverage is a microphone.
I'm sorry. This coverage does not apply for bodily injury to a person who makes or whose representative makes a settlement without our written consent. In Raines, the unfortunate plaintiff had made a settlement without giving American Family written consent. American Family denied UIM coverage based upon that clear statement. In Raines, that case was decided by saying that insured's breach was a formalistic breach. And unless American Family can show prejudice, they were not going to deny the insurance coverage to the policyholder that they had paid for.
So, counsel, how do you answer Ms. Curtis's argument on behalf of the American Family that they are damaged, that there is prejudice to them because they are going to, in many cases, anyway, have to fight out questions of liability that rightly should be fought out between the plaintiff and the tort feasor?
Well, her examples about somebody could settle for $10,000 out of a $50,000 policy and take their chances against the UIM carrier, and that would be prudent. I mean, I don't know exactly where she gets the idea that would be prudent for a victim. In this case, if Mr. Danbeck followed her prudent advice and took $10,000 and took his chances against American Family, it's the victim who gives up that gap. It's the victim who suffers the gap because they give credit for the full dollar between what they take and the policy limits. In this case, Mr. Danbeck would have lost $40,000 if he would have ultimately got the $70,000 that we agreed to. So the incentive is there for the victim to get as much as possible from the underlying carrier.
Well, counsel, her argument and caused me concern. I call it the strategy for subterfuge, and that is for subterfuge of the system. Just on the very point that you're making,
yes,
here, you know, here I am an attorney, okay? And I've got a 50,000 limits. I'm going to say to my client, plaintiff, I'm going to say, let's settle. Let's settle with the underlying insurance company for $40,000, $35,000. Give them a credit for $50,000. We'll go against my insurance company. Why am I going to do that? Because in my $35,000 settlement, I'm going to release the underlying insurance company, and I'm going to release the tortfeasor. So now, what do you have? You have a tortfeasor who's not engaged in this adversary system. A tortfeasor that would just as soon go to Florida rather than show up for depositions. A tortfeasor who's been released for all liability and has no incentive, in fact, maybe even could be co-opted to play along with the game. Look, we'll give you 35, we'll settle for 35,000. But you cooperate in your testimony. I mean, it really isn't clear, is it, how far, let's talk. isn't there a real possibility for subterfuge when you're now going against your own insurance carrier on the excess, and they have to rely on a defendant tortfeasor who has no incentive to play ball for them except perhaps to clear his or her good name or to be a good American and show up in court?
Well, they would have the same incentives either way. I mean, I don't know whether the tortfeasor...
No money. I'm talking about money as an incentive.
I don't know.
They released a liability, and maybe even they could be released a liability. I won't suggest anything inappropriate, but could be released liability. They have no duty to cooperate. They have no duty to cooperate with the excess carrier, and probably, given the hassle of the court system, sometimes little incentive to cooperate with the excess carrier.
The missing point there is the Vogt issue.
It's in fact the
Vogt issue. It's in fact the UIM carrier who makes the final determination and gives the permission to release the underinsured carrier and the tortfeasor. They have that policy provision. Their interest is a subrogation interest, wondering whether the tortfeasor has assets that they might be able to get at over and above the coverage. So they agree to release the tortfeasor, and the vote, they're to be given 30 days, and they're to make that assessment. They can make that assessment on all the issues that the Justice just talked about, but they ultimately agree for the victim to sign that release.
What does it say they have to agree to a settlement?
It doesn't say they have to agree to a settlement under Volk. They have to be given written notice that the plaintiff intends to settle the underinsured motorist case, and they have to be given the opportunity to step into the shoes of that underinsured motorist carrier and preserve their subrogation rights against the tortfeasor. If the tortfeasor happens to be a millionaire and he's underinsured, the underinsured carrier could substitute, in this case, the $48,000 with a check.
Even if there's not a lawsuit pending?
Yes.
So
yes.
Got to give him notice.
Yes.
So you're saying that...
And that was the Raines case. Unfortunately, the plaintiff didn't give notice in that case, but that's correct.
And so, as a result of that, you're saying... this concept that the American family is being done in just doesn't play out.
Right.
Okay.
And they're really giving examples in terms of the take a dollar and then pursue the UIM carrier. I mean, those are frivolity type examples, and it's sort of the tail wagging the dog. I think the much more likely scenario is the scenario I gave in my example where a person who's unrepresented and doesn't have a clue about this policy sentence goes out and settles his case for a little less than the limits and totally loses all of his underinsured motorist coverage, which he had paid for. And I see my time is up. I would simply urge the court to adopt what I think was a very well-reasoned and encompassed all the issues, policy reasons, contract interpretation, in the trial court's opinion, and I would urge this court to overturn the ruling of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our hearing in 99-1142.